Content note. This episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains references to religion and religious discussion, philosophical discussions, and also some difficult concepts about choices and loving difficult people, and parenting and raising of children. Hi folks, this is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Today we continue with the final chapter of A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Ain.
It's the final chapter.
I don't know how that's going to get processed, but hey, hopefully it won't have clipped.
I'm trying to summon some energy. My tanks are rather dry today, so we're persevering, folks. I know it's been a few weeks since you've last heard our wonderful sultry voices, but we had that we asked for feedback, and based on everything we got, we've decided, Rue and I talked a lot about it, and we decided to go with what originally was our option three, moving forward after this final chapter of A Wrinkle in Time. We'll tell you the next book, and then we are going to go away for a while. We're going to record the entirety of that book week by week, and then when it's done, we will release it week by week. But in the interim, we have decided we may retool this. We may take a while before it goes into effect, but our idea, our plan, is to keep the theme of the podcast, So Many Books, So Little Time, and perhaps use these monthly episodes as you're waiting for a new book to be completed to talk about more contemporary books, maybe books of poetry, maybe we can do Shakespeare plays, maybe, you know, philosophy or nonfiction. But basically, the idea that Rue and I will read a book in our own time, and then we will come together and we will discuss it for about an hour or maybe a little more, considering how often we stay on topic, which, you know, is not that often, but we'll do our best. You know, it might be a good way to look into, like, what's popular out there, you know, what's winning those Book of the Year awards and popular sites, and maybe seeing what we think of those stories. This is definitely an area where suggestions from you listeners would be more appreciated. I won't say more appreciated, because if you have any suggestions for books you'd like us to read in our normal way, we'd love to hear from you as well. But, you know, it might be easier to just throw out a book you loved reading last year, because we can actually do an episode on that, because we can't, you know, read anything contemporary on the podcast for all those dreaded copyright reasons.
Yeah, so the focus would be more the discussion of the content rather than reading the actual content, for the reasons that Dave has pointed out. So it's something that we'll figure out exactly how frequently it'll be. Likely it'll be a monthly thing whilst we get the recording of the book in the reel. And yeah, so on that note, however, it has been a while. There's been a few health issues. There's been recovering from said health issues. There's been life issues. But we're back, only to tell you that we will be gone for a bit. But, you know, that's the way it is. But in the meantime, for listening pressure, at least we'll have the final chapter for A Wrinkle in Time down. Bearing in mind that this is actually not a short chapter.
Hmm.
Because it is wrapping up all the loose threads.
Well, if you recall the last episode, which may be very fresh in your minds if you're listening to this sometime in the future and just going through the whole thing, but looking at that it was going to be the final chapter, and considering where last chapter stopped, I mused, this book's going to have to do some heavy lifting to wrap all this up in a tidy little bow. And it could be like, you know, you did say there are future books, and I don't know if Madeline Lang at this point in time foresaw rewriting other books. You know, these days, leaving space open for sequels seems to be baked into what a lot of media is, whether it be books or games or movies or TV shows. Although with TV, that's kind of the format, right? You always want to kind of get as much as you can. But yeah, I mean, we've complained. Yeah, complained is the right word on the podcast about this before. I've regaled you with certain books where it was very obvious that they were trying to set themselves up for sequels. And it really, at least in that case, it really ruined the flow of the story. Now, I don't think Madeline Lang is going to do that, but I do have to wonder if, like, not everything's going to be wrapped up at the end of this. And maybe the core conflict will, but there might be some lingering threads that are left for the future. I know you know, and you probably can't tell me for risk of spoiling how the story ends, but those are my thoughts at the moment.
And I mean, the title of this chapter is, of course, interesting. It's a bit of a challenge. You have The Foolish and the Weak as the title, which, you know, in itself is also ominous. But remembering last, let's just have a quick recap. In terms of last chapter, we had Meg was recovering from the tessering away from Kamazotz, and trying to escape the control of it. Then there was the quote unquote beasts, whose planet they landed on, which is on a twin planet to Kamazotz. It's in the same system, but it's just not affected by it yet at this point in time. And there's a lot of protective behavior. There's frustration and guilt, and Meg is trying to explain to creatures who do not have a concept of sight, and trying to explain why it's important for them to actually act and to help Charles Wallace, the salvage and the rescue of Charles Wallace, and also trying to explain who Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch are, without using verbal descriptions. Like, is it not verbal? Visual descriptions. And it's really interesting to see how difficult it is to express without using language that relies on appearance.
We talk even about metaphorical. So much of our vocabulary is vision-based.
And I mean, there's movements that argue it's ableist to use expressions such as colorblind. And I mean, there's other issues with that word, or tone deaf, or those kind of, if you use it in a sense to depict that someone doesn't know. So the ignorance being depicted as say tone deafness or tactlessness being that kind of thing. And there's a bit of a split in the different communities that are actually affected by those that are in those states where they have vision and hearing variations. So it's mixed. What's interesting to me is that we use sight as an analogy, and we've talked about it. It's like sight and hearing and all these things are also used. They're the literal senses, but they're also the concept of our intellectual capacity to grasp or intuit things, or comprehend or develop understanding. And that's that we use the expression, for example, insight. Insight has technically nothing to do with vision, but we have the word sight in there, right? But it's a different kind of sight.
It's looking inwards.
Yep. It's an internal vision.
Which I want to say is what the beasts are all about. They cannot see, but they know the heart of things. They know what things are.
Yes, so they have extreme insight. But in terms of, so if you're communicating with them, it has to be through that space of profound insight. So there was a moment where Calvin almost got through, but it just wasn't quite enough. And part of it is also because Meg is so distressed and it was adding to the issues. Okay, so Calvin had almost gotten through, and then no, and the reason there was an issue was they are asking, why can't they communicate what's going on? Saying they're very young, and on their Earth, they don't communicate with other planets. They all revolve alone in space. And then the creature goes, oh, but aren't they lonely?
Hmm.
Right? And then suddenly you have this thundering voice of, we are here. So Mrs. Watsit has arrived.
Mm.
At least. Well, yes. And so we have the arrival of the creatures that they can't really explain. They can't describe. And now we will see how the beasts recognize them and see them as well and perceive them, which will be interesting. And hopefully have a wrapped up episode of the entire chapter. Yes. And book. But we'll see. Chapter 12, The Foolish and the Weak. Meg could see nothing, but she felt her heart pounding with hope. With one accord, all the beasts rose to their feet, turned toward one of the arched openings, and bowed their heads and tentacles in greeting. Mrs. Watsit appeared, standing between two columns. Beside her came Mrs. Hu, and behind them a quivering of light. The three of them were somehow not quite the same as they had been when Meg had first seen them. Their outlines seemed blurred, colors ran together as in a wet watercolor painting, but they were there. They were recognizable. They were themselves. Meg pulled herself away from Aunt Beast, jumped to the floor, and rushed at Mrs. Watsit. But Mrs. Watsit held up a warning hand, and Meg realized that she was not completely materialized, that she was light and not substance, and embracing her now would have been like trying to hug a sunbeam. We had to hurry, so there wasn't quite time. You wanted us? Mrs. Watsit asked. The tallest of the beasts bowed again and took a step away from the table and toward Mrs. Watsit. It is a question of the little boy. Father left him, Meg cried. He left him on Camazotz. Appallingly, Mrs. Watsit's voice was cold. And what do you expect us to do? Meg pressed her knuckles against her teeth so that the braces cut her skin. Then she flung out her arms pleadingly. But it's Charles Wallace. It has him, Mrs. Watsit. Save him. Please save him. You know that we can do nothing on Camazotz, Mrs. Watsit said, her voice still cold. You mean you'll let Charles be caught by it forever? Meg's voice rose shrilly. Did I say that? But we can't do anything. You know we can't. We tried, Mrs. Watsit. You have to save him. Meg, this is not our way, Mrs. Watsit said sadly. I thought you would know that this is not our way. Mr. Murray took a step forward and bowed, and to Meg's amazement, the three ladies bowed back to him. I don't believe we've been introduced, Mrs. Watsit said. It's Father. You know it's Father. Meg's angry impatience grew. Father, Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Hu, and Mrs. Witch. I'm very glad to... Mr. Murray mumbled, then went on. I'm sorry, my glasses were broken, and I can't see you very well. It's not necessary to see us, Mrs. Watsit said. If you could teach me enough more about the Tesseract so that I could get back to Camazotz. What then? Came Mrs. Witch's surprising voice. I will try to take my child away from it. And you know that you will not succeed? There is nothing left except to try. Mrs. Watsit spoke gently. I'm sorry. We cannot allow you to go. Then let me, Calvin suggested. I almost got him away before. Mrs. Watsit shook her head. No, Calvin. Charles has gone even deeper into it. You will not be permitted to throw yourself in with him, for that, you must realize, is what would happen. There was a long silence. All the soft rays, filtering into the great hall, seemed to concentrate on Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Hu, and the faint light that must be Mrs. Witch. No one spoke. One of the beasts moved a tendril slowly back and forth across the stone tabletop. At last Meg could stand it no longer, and she cried out despairingly, Then what are you going to do? Are you just going to throw Charles away? Mrs. Witch's voice rolled formidably across the hall. "Silence, child." But Meg could not be silent. She pressed closely against Aunt Beast, but Aunt Beast did not put the protecting tentacles around her. "I can't go," Meg cried. "I can't. You know I can't." "Did anybody ask you to?" The grim voice made Meg's skin prickle into goose flesh. She burst into tears. She started beating at Aunt Beast like a small child having a tantrum. Her tears rained down her face and spattered Aunt Beast's fur. Aunt Beast stood quietly against the assault. "All right, I'll go," Meg sobbed. "I know you want me to go." "We want nothing from you that you do without grace," Mrs. Watsit said, "or that you do without understanding." Meg's tears stopped as abruptly as they had started. "But I do understand." She felt tired and unexpectedly peaceful. Now the coldness that under Aunt Beast's ministrations had left her body had also left her mind. She looked toward her father, and her confused anger was gone, and she felt only love and pride. She smiled at him, asking forgiveness, and then pressed up against Aunt Beast. This time, Aunt Beast's arm went around her. Mrs. Witch's voice was grave. "What do you understand?" "That it has to be me. It can't be anybody else. I don't understand Charles, but he understands me. I'm the one who's closest to him. Father's been away for so long since Charles Wallace was a baby. They don't know each other. And Calvin's only known Charles for such a little time. If it had been longer, then he would have been the one, but..." "Oh, I see, I understand. It has to be me. There isn't anyone else." Mr. Murray, who had been sitting, his elbows on his knees, his chin on his fists, rose. "I will not allow it." "Why?" Mrs. Witch demanded. "Look, I don't know what or who you are, and at this point I don't care. I will not allow my daughter to go alone into this danger." "Why?" "You know what the outcome will probably be, and she's weak now, weaker than she was before. She was almost killed by the black thing. I fail to understand how you can even consider such a thing." Calvin jumped down. "Maybe it's right about you, or maybe you're in league with it. I'm the one to go if anybody goes. Why did you bring me along at all? To take care of Meg. You said so yourself." "But you have done that," Mrs. Watsit assured him. "I haven't done anything," Calvin shouted. "You can't send Meg. I won't allow it. I'll put my foot down. I won't permit it." "Don't you see that you're making something that is already hard for Meg even harder?" Mrs. Watsit asked him. Aunt Beast turned tentacles towards Mrs. Watsit. "Is she strong enough to test her again? You know what she's been through." "If Witch takes her, she can manage," Mrs. Watsit said. "If it will help, I could go too and hold her." Aunt Beast's arm around Meg tightened. "Oh, Aunt Beast," Meg started. But Mrs. Watsit cut her off. "No." "I was afraid not," Aunt Beast said humbly. "I just wanted you to know that I would." Mrs. Watsit, Mr. Murray frowned and pushed his hair back from his face. Then he shoved with his middle finger at his nose, as though he were trying to get spectacles closer to his eyes. "Are you remembering that she is only a child?" "And she's backward," Calvin bellowed. "I resent that," Meg said hotly, hoping that indignation would control her trembling. "I am better than you at math, and you know it." "Do you have the courage to go alone?" Mrs. Watsit asked her. Meg's voice was flat. "No, but it doesn't matter." She turned to her father and Calvin. "You know it's the only thing to do. You know they'd never send me alone if..." "How do we know they're not in league with it?" Mr. Murray demanded. "Father!" "No, Meg," Mrs. Watsit said. "I do not blame your father for being angry and suspicious and frightened, and I cannot pretend that we are doing anything but sending you into the gravest kind of danger. I have to acknowledge quite openly that it may be a fatal danger. I know this. But I do not believe it, and the happy medium doesn't believe it either." "Can't she see what's going to happen?" Calvin asked. "Oh, not in this kind of thing." Mrs. Watsit sounded surprised at his question. "If we knew ahead of time what was going to happen, we'd be like the people on Camazotz, with no lives of our own, with everything all planned and done for us. How can I explain it to you?" "Oh, I know. In your language, you have a form of poetry called the sonnet. Yes, yes, Calvin said impatiently. What's that got to do with a happy medium? Kindly pay me the courtesy of listening to me. Mrs. Watts's voice was stern, and for a moment Calvin stopped pawing the ground like a nervous colt. It is a very strict form of poetry, is it not? Yes. There are 14 lines, I believe, all in iambic pentameter. That's a very strict rhythm or meter, yes? Yes, Calvin nodded. And each line has to end with a rigid rhyme pattern. And if the poet does not do it exactly this way, it is not a sonnet, is it? No. But within this strict form, the poet has complete freedom to say whatever he wants, doesn't he? Yes. Calvin nodded again. So, Mrs. Watsit said, so what? Oh, do not be stupid, boy, Mrs. Watsit scolded. You know perfectly well what I'm driving at. You mean you're comparing our lives to a sonnet? A strict form, but freedom within it. Yes, Mrs. Watsit said. You're given the form, but you have to write the sonnet yourself. What you say is completely up to you. Please, Meg said. Please, if I've got to go, I want to go and get it over with. Each minute you put it off makes it harder. She is right, boomed Mrs. Witch's voice. It is time. You may say goodbye, Mrs. Watsit was not giving her permission, but a command. Meg curtsied clumsily to the beast. Thank you all very much. I know you saved my life. She did not add what she could not help thinking. Saved it for what? So that it could get me. She put her arms around Aunt Beast, pressed up against the soft, fragrant fur. Thank you, she whispered. I love you. And I you, little one. Aunt Beast pressed gentle tendrils against Meg's face. Cal, Meg said, holding out her hand. Calvin came to her and took her hand, then drew her roughly to him and kissed her. He didn't say anything, and he turned away before he had a chance to see the surprised happiness that brightened Meg's eyes. At last she turned to her father. I'm sorry, father. He took both her hands in his, bent down to her with his short-sighted eyes. Sorry for what, Megatron? Tears almost came to her eyes at the gentle use of the old nickname. I wanted you to do it all for me. I wanted everything to be all easy and simple, so I tried to pretend that it was all your fault because I was scared and I didn't want to have to do anything myself. But I wanted to do it for you, Mr. Murray said. That's what every parent wants. He looked into her dark, frightened eyes. I won't let you go, Meg. I am going. No, Mrs. Watson's voice was sterner than Meg had ever heard it. You are going to allow Meg the privilege of accepting this danger. You are a wise man, Mr. Murray. You are going to let her go. Mr. Murray sighed. He drew Meg close to him. Little Megaparsec, don't be afraid to be afraid. We will try to have courage for you. That's all we can do. Mother was always shoving me out in the world, Meg said. She'd want me to do this. You know she would. Tell her. She started, choked, and then held up her head and said, No, never mind. I'll tell her myself. Good girl. Of course you will. Now Meg walked slowly around the great table to where Mrs. Watsit was still poised between the columns. Are you going with me? No, only Mrs. Witch. The black thing. Fear made her voice tremble. When Father tethered me through it, it almost got me. Your father is singularly inexperienced, Mrs. Watsit said. Though a fine man and worth teaching, and at the moment he still treats tethering as though he were working with a machine. We will not let the black thing get you, I don't think. This was not exactly comforting. The momentary vision and faith that had come to Meg dwindled. But suppose I can't get Charles Wallace away from it. Stop, Mrs. Watsit held up her hand. We gave you gifts the last time we took you to Camazotz. We will not let you go empty-handed this time. But what we can give you now is nothing you can touch with your hands. I give you my love, Meg. Never forget that. My love, always. Mrs. Hu, eyes shining behind spectacles, beamed at Meg. Meg felt in her blazer pocket and handed back the spectacles she had used on Camazotz. Your father is right. Mrs. Hu took the spectacles and hid them somewhere in the folds of her robes. The virtue is gone from them. And what I have to give you this time, you must try to understand not word by word, but in a flash, as you understand the Tesseract. Listen, Meg, listen well. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are. She paused, and then she said, May the right prevail. Her spectacles seemed to flicker. Behind her, through her, one of the columns became visible. There was a final gleam from the glasses, and she was gone. Meg looked nervously to where Mrs. Watsett had been standing before Mrs. Hu spoke, but Mrs. Watsett was no longer there. No, Mr. Murray cried, and stepped toward Meg. Mrs. Witch's voice came through her shimmer. I cannot hold your hand, child. Immediately Meg was swept into darkness, into nothingness, and then into the icy devouring cold of the black thing. Mrs. Witch won't let it get me, she thought over and over, while the cold of the black thing seemed to crunch at her bones. Then they were through it, and she was standing breathlessly on her feet on the same hill on which they had first landed on Camazotz. She was cold and a little numb, but no worse than she had often been in the winter in the country when she had spent an afternoon skating on the pond. She looked around. She was completely alone. Her heart began to pound. Then, seeming to echo from all around her, came Mrs. Witch's unforgettable voice. I have not given you my gift. You have something that it has not. This something is your only weapon, but you must find it for yourself. Then the voice ceased, and Meg knew that she was alone. She walked slowly down the hill, her heart thumping painfully against her ribs. There below her was the same row of identical houses they had seen before, and beyond these the linear buildings of the city. She walked along the quiet street. It was dark, and the street was deserted. No children playing ball or skipping rope. No mother figures at the door. No father figures returning from work. In the same window of each house was a light, and as Meg walked down the street, all the lights were extinguished simultaneously. Was it because of her presence, or was it simply that it was time for lights out? She felt numb, beyond rage or disappointment or even fear. She put one foot ahead of the other with precise regularity, not allowing her pace to lag. She was not thinking, she was not planning. She was simply walking slowly but steadily toward the city and the domed building where it lay. Now she approached the outlying buildings of the city. In each of them was a vertical line of light. But it was a dim, eerie light, not the warm light of stairways and cities at home. And there were no isolated, brightly lit windows where someone was working late or an office was being cleaned. Out of each building came one man, perhaps a watchman, and each man started walking the width of the building. They appeared not to see her. At any rate, they paid no attention to her whatsoever, and she went on past them. What have I got that it hasn't got? She thought suddenly. What have I possibly got? Now she was walking by the tallest of the business buildings. More dim vertical lines of light. The walls glowed slightly to give a faint illumination to the streets. Central intelligence was ahead of her. Was the man with red eyes still sitting there? Or was he allowed to go to bed? But this was not where she must go. Though the man with red eyes seemed the kind old gentleman he claimed to be when compared with it. But he was no longer of any consequence in the search for Charles Wallace. She must go directly to it. It isn't used to being resisted. Father said that's how he managed, and how Calvin and I managed as long as we did. Father saved me then. There's nobody here to save me now. I have to do it myself. I have to resist it by myself. Is that what I have that it hasn't got? No, I'm sure it can resist. It just isn't used to having other people resist. Central intelligence blocked with its huge rectangle the end of the square. She turned to walk around it, and almost imperceptibly, her steps slowed. It was not far to the great dome which housed it. I'm going to Charles Wallace. That's what's important. That's what I have to think of. I wish I could feel numb again the way I did at first. Suppose it has him somewhere else. Suppose he isn't there. I have to go there first anyhow. That's the only way I can find out. Her steps got slower and slower. As she passed the great bronze doors, the huge slabs of the central intelligence building, she finally saw ahead of her the strange light, pulsing dome of it. Father said it was all right for me to be afraid. He said to go ahead and be afraid. And Mrs. Hu said, I don't understand what she said, but I think it was meant to make me not hate being only me, and me being the way I am. And Mrs. Watson said to remember that she loves me. That's what I have to think about. Not about being afraid, or not as smart as it. Mrs. Watson loves me. That's quite something, to be loved by someone like Mrs. Watson. She was there. No matter how slowly her feet had taken her at the end, they had taken her there. Directly ahead of her was the circular building, its walls glowing with violet flame, its silvery roof pulsing with a light that seemed to Meg to be insane. Again she could feel the light, neither warm nor cold, but reaching out to touch her, pulling her towards it. There was a sudden sucking, and she was within. It was as though the wind had been knocked out of her. She gasped for breath in her own rhythm, not the permeating pulsing of it. She could feel the inexorable beat within her body, controlling her heart, her lungs. But not herself. Not Meg. It did not quite have her. She blinked her eyes rapidly and against the rhythm until the redness before them cleared and she could see. There was the brain, there was it, lying pulsing and quivering on the dais, soft and exposed and nauseating. Charles Wallace was crouched beside it, his eyes still slowly twirling, his jaw still slack, as she had seen him before, with a tick in his forehead, reiterating the revolting rhythm of it.
Yeah.
As she saw him, it was again as though she had been punched in the stomach, for she had to realize afresh that she was seeing Charles, and yet it was not Charles at all. Where was Charles Wallace, her own beloved Charles Wallace? What is it that I have got that it hasn't got? You have nothing that it hasn't got, Charles Wallace said coldly. How nice to have you back, dear sister. We have been waiting for you. We knew that Mrs. Watson would send you. She is our friend, you know. For an appalling moment, Meg believed, and in that moment she felt her brain being gathered up into it. No, she screamed at the top of her lungs. No, you lie. For a moment she was free from its clutches again. As long as I can stay angry enough, it can't get me. Is that what I have that it doesn't have? Nonsense, Charles Wallace said. You have nothing that it doesn't have. You're lying, she replied, and she felt only anger towards this boy who was not Charles Wallace at all. No, it was not anger. It was loathing. It was hatred, sheer and unadulterated, and as she became lost in hatred, she also began to be lost in it. The red miasma swam before her eyes, her stomach churned in its rhythm, her body trembled with the strength of her hatred and the strength of it. With the last vestige of consciousness, she jerked her mind and body. Hate was nothing that it didn't have. It knew all about hate. You're lying about that, and you were lying about Mrs. Watson, she screamed. Mrs. Watson hates you, Charles Wallace said. And that was where it made its fatal mistake. For, as Meg said, automatically, Mrs. Watson loves me. That's what she told me, that she loves me. Suddenly, she knew. She knew. Love. That was what she had that it did not have. She had Mrs. Watsit's love, and her father's, and her mother's, and the real Charles Wallace's love, and the twins, and Aunt Beast's. And she had her love for them. But how could she use it? What was she meant to do? If she could give love to it, perhaps it would shrivel up and die, for she was sure that it could not withstand love. But she, in all her weakness and foolishness and baseness and nothingness, was incapable of loving it. Perhaps it was not too much to ask of her, but she could not do it. But she could love Charles Wallace. She could stand there and she could love Charles Wallace, her own Charles Wallace, the real Charles Wallace, the child for whom she had come back to Kamazots, to it, the baby who was so much more than she was, and who was yet so utterly vulnerable. She could love Charles Wallace. Charles, Charles, I love you, my baby brother, who always takes care of me. Come back to me, Charles Wallace. Come away from it. Come back, come home. I love you, Charles. Oh, Charles Wallace, I love you. Tears were streaming down her cheeks, but she was unaware of them. Now she was even able to look at him, at this animated thing that was not her own Charles Wallace at all. She was able to look and love. I love you, Charles Wallace. You are my darling and my dear, and the light of my life and the treasure of my heart. I love you, I love you, I love you. Slowly his mouth closed. Slowly his eyes stopped their twirling. The tick in the forehead ceased its revolting twitch. Slowly he advanced toward her. I love you, she cried. I love you, Charles Wallace, I love you. Then suddenly he was running, pelting. He was in her arms. He was shrieking with sobs. Meg, Meg, Meg! I love you, Charles, she cried again, her sobs almost as loud as his, her tears mingling with his. I love you. I love you, I love you. A whirl of darkness, an icy cold blast, an angry, resentful howl that seemed to tear through her. Darkness again. Through the darkness to save her came a sense of Mrs. Watsit's presence, so that she knew it could not be it who now had her in its clutches. And then the feel of earth beneath her, of something in her arms, and she was rolling over on the sweet-smelling autumnal earth, and Charles Wallace was crying out, Meg! Oh, Meg! Now she was hugging him close to her, and his little arms were clasped tightly about her neck. Meg, you saved me! You saved me! He said over and over. Meg! Came a call. And there were her father and Calvin, hurrying through the darkness toward them. Still holding Charles, she struggled to stand up and look around. Father, Cal, where are we? Charles Wallace, holding her hand tightly, was looking around too. And suddenly he laughed, his own sweet, contagious laugh. In the twins' vegetable garden, and we landed in the broccoli. Sorry. Meg began to laugh too. At the same time that she was trying to hug her father, to hug Calvin, and not to let go of Charles Wallace for one second. Meg, you did it, Calvin shouted. You saved Charles. I am very proud of you, my daughter. Mr. Murray kissed her gravely and then turned toward the house. Now I must go in to Mother. Meg could tell that he was trying to control his anxiety and eagerness. Look, she pointed to the house, and there were the twins and Mrs. Murray, walking toward them through the long wet grass. First thing tomorrow, I must get some new glasses, Mr. Murray said, squinting in the moonlight, and then starting to run towards his wife. Dennis's voice came crossly over the lawn. Hey, Meg, it's bedtime. Sandy suddenly yelled, Father! Mr. Murray was running across the lawn, Mrs. Murray running toward him, and they were in each other's arms, and there was a tremendous happy jumble of arms and legs and hugging, the older Murrays and Meg and Charles Wallace and the twins, and Calvin grinning by them until Meg reached out and pulled him in, and Mrs. Murray gave him a special hug all of his own. They were talking and laughing all at once, when they were startled by a crash, and Fortinbras, who could bear being left out of the happiness not one moment longer, catapulted his sleek black body right through the screen door to the kitchen. He dashed across the lawn to join in the joy and almost knocked them all over in the exuberance of his greeting. Meg knew all at once that Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch must be near, because all through her she felt a flooding of joy and of love that was even greater and deeper than the joy and love which were already there. She stopped laughing and listened, and Charles listened too. Hush! Then there was a whirring, and Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch were standing in front of them, and the joy and love were so tangible that Meg felt that if she only knew where to reach, she could touch it with her bare hands. Mrs. Watsit said breathlessly, "Oh, my darlings, I'm so sorry. We don't have time to say goodbye to you properly. You see, we have to..." But they never learned what it was that Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch had to do, for there was a gust of wind, and they were gone.
Oh, boy. Really? Really? Yep. That's where you're going to end it?
Yep. Hey, look. We know that their job is like this eternal battle with the darkness.
Yep. I know.
So you can, yes. So that it's a thing. But there's so much joy and happiness at the end.
Yeah, look, it's fine.
And yes, there are other books, and you're going to probably want to read them.
Yeah, I probably will.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
that was a lovely final chapter. Even see, here's the thing. I'm actually not mad that it ends with them saying we have to go. Boom. It's more that it just, I don't know. And this could just be my feelings, but yeah, it felt very abrupt at the ending. It's kind of like you do have the very nice family reunion, and then suddenly it's like, goodbye, end the book.
Yes, and there's a reason again for that, because they have to. It can, like, the series has a bit of that, because the idea is that it's constant. It's a constant thing, a constant space that is being occupied. I'm trying to see if there's a different version of the ending. Just give me a sec. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just want to also say that this might be the cynic in me, or, you know, just having experienced many other fantasy stories, but during that entire happy reunion and happy ending, I was waiting for Meg to be kind of pulled back out of like a reverie, you know, like that was all in her mind and she still had to fight it. So I was kind of pleasantly surprised that that was not the case.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's, I think the difference is that when it talks about peace, it's not talking about peace in the sense of contentment. Mm. It's talking about peace in the concept of that you don't have to make any choices anymore.
Mm.
And although that is a kind of peace, it's not a kind of peace that has space for love. Because love requires choice. Yeah. And I think that's one of the big topics that, I mean, it is a children's book, so it is it is talking about, but it's still talking about from very big topics.
Well, that, and maybe that's also why, even though if you just say it out loud that Meg defeats it with the power of love, that sounds cheesy, like so cliched, but it worked within the story.
Yes, because it was all about it's removing of choice, removing of the mess, absolute order as determined and dictated by an entity.
And I think also, actually, now just thinking about it, I think the reason the love thing did not seem hackneyed in this instance is because it came naturally out of Meg choosing to hate and then realizing that was the wrong way forward.
Well, realizing that's something that it has. You can't, it's the whole concept of you can't fight fire with fire. And I mean, you can't. Mm-hmm. You can use fire to deplete of a fuel source, but you don't genuinely, like, it's not a legitimate thing. It's not that you're actually fighting the fire with the fire.
Anger begets anger.
Yes, it doesn't lead anywhere. It's not a constructive outcome. But it was honest about the fact that Meg couldn't make herself love it.
Yeah, no. I thought that was really good too, because so much of so many of our stories. The stories behind many of our world's religions are basically, you know, they preach love no matter what.
Yeah.
And what makes some of the prophets and the great figures is they were able to love everybody no matter how heinous, whereas we mere mortals, especially myself, you know, when I think of some of who I think the most heinous people are at this point in time, I cannot bring myself to extend love and mercy and kindness toward when I think of them. It's very difficult for me.
And I think that that's that paragraph where it says, if she could give love to it, perhaps it would shrivel up and die.
Yeah.
For she was sure that it could not withstand love. But she, in all her weakness and foolishness and baseness and nothingness, was incapable of loving it. Perhaps it was not too much to ask of her, but she could not do it. So she's straight up gone, this is maybe, but I can't do it. I just can't.
Yeah. And actually, so she,
yeah. And that makes it more, yeah. It because she was hating the animated Charles Wallace, and that was actually a problem.
Mm. The thing that completely saved him was loving not what he became, but who he is. Kind of, you know, that's also the lesson of the beasts, you know, not the outward or I guess the idea that it had not completely overtaken him, because at the core there was still something left, which, you know, earlier in the book talked about how Charles Wallace wanted to tuck a part of him away while when he went into the lion's den, to use another metaphor. Yeah. And maybe that was the bit that Meg was able to reach to save. But I also like the other reason the love worked is it was set up so nicely with that was the gift that Mrs. Watson gave her before she arrived back on Camazotz. And the book makes a point to say that was basically the fatal flaw in its plan was when it decided to try and use... you know, to say Mrs. Watson hates her, and suddenly because she already had the love affirmed, it was basically the key to the entire puzzle.
Yeah, it's beautiful how it manages to, like, I don't know if it's impossible to love everyone.
Mm.
I think it is. I think it's something that is very, very, very difficult. And I think that also our concept of what it means to love and what that means in terms of actions and what that means in terms of responsibility and mercy, as you're saying, like it's hard to process that as a concept. Like, for example, I can love humanity in terms of I can love human beings for what they have as, what the potential is in terms of humans are capable of great acts of beauty and kindness and all these wonderful things. Mm-hmm. And part of it is choice. And part of it is also how they are, someone is, I guess, trained to see themselves as well. If you feel like you don't have a choice, we had a discussion before our chat, before our recording today about this idea of limiting perceptions and what distinguishing between wants and needs and how we are affected by what is extrinsically placed on us, how we see ourselves is influenced by others very easily if we're in a state where we are vulnerable enough to it. So yeah, it's I can love what humans can be and I can love what a person could be, but doesn't mean that I'm going to allow for injustice. So you loving does not make someone exempt from justice.
But you also talked about a potential. Does that mean that the tricky part for you at the moment is loving humans as they are?
I think for me, I love people for... I think it is you love the potential that a human being has for choices, that every human being, no matter where they're at, they can make a choice. But I don't have to love the choices people make. I don't have to love the consequences of the choices people make. I can create the environment or I can contribute to the environment that encourages people to consider their choices and to consider that they have a choice. Yeah?
So the whole kind of love the sin or hate the sin.
No, I don't even hate the sin. I see the sin as... it's the choice that has been made, and there is a consequence to that choice. It's not that I necessarily... same thing that I have with emotions. I don't necessarily believe there are good and bad emotions. I just think that there are emotions that we determine, like we, that exist, that are responses. Some are trained, some are how we're educated, some are base instinct, some are, there's the nurture, there's the nature and the nurture and all that. And we then decide, for example, with anger, okay, am I going to sit here, consider why I am feeling angry, and then identify what it is that it's trying to motivate me to address. What's usually anger is, for example, it's triggered off by, usually anger is something that might be triggered off when you see a difference between what you are hoping for and what you actually are experiencing. So it's disappointment. There's a disappointment-based anger. There's injustice. So what is it that's causing it, and how do I choose to act on it? So I don't see emotions necessarily as negative, and it's helped a lot for me personally, because I no longer go, oh, I shouldn't be angry. It's like, okay, I am angry. Why am I angry?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you actually have to address the underlying what's going on behind it. Doesn't mean that you dwell and stay in that state, but you kind of go, oh, okay, that's happened. Why has that happened? What can I do about this? And it's not saying that you can't feel upset or angry. You're not justified, or sometimes you are, sometimes you're not. Only you can sit there and actually fact, like, measure whether it's a reality based, or if it's just a trigger, you know, things like that. So it's complex.
Can I just interject there the idea of it being justifiable? Let me just think of the right word for it. There it is. Every emotion you are feeling is valid because you are feeling it for a reason. Yes. Whether it is justifiable, I guess that's a further exploration of the emotion.
Yes.
But, you know, never feel, as you say, it's not like anger is bad, and you shouldn't feel bad for feeling anger or shame or guilt or sadness. Yeah. Notice that at the moment I'm listing all the what we perceive as negative emotion. But even, you know, sometimes we can feel guilt for being happy in certain circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's relief. Why would you feel relief when your appointment has been canceled? Why am I feeling relief? Why am I feeling joy and relief? You know, like that kind of thing. And then you go, oh, actually, I'm not feeling particularly good today, and I didn't listen to my body. And that's why I'm feeling relief that, you know, my friend's birthday was canceled or whatever. Like, you know, that kind of stuff that can happen. And you feel guilt about the fact that you feel relieved that you don't have to go to a social commitment or whatever. So it's messy, and we're humans, and it's okay to be messy. I think the difference is that and much like this book has been really emphasizing, is you choose, you make choices. There are consequences and impact of the choices we make. And that's not a bad thing. If someone took away choice from us and we just had no space to grow and develop and see what the impact is of our choices.
But also
learn.
I think a very pivotal point of that final chapter, I'm thinking more about it, is Meg had no courage. She wasn't feeling brave, but she became determined. She basically said, look, I'm not feeling up to it, but I know it has to be done. So she was able to somehow push through that.
Yeah. And that's again, it's a choice. To make a choice, but also notice that she finally kind of, when it came to her father, she said the very thing that we'd been discussing, that she wanted everything to be simple and easy and done for her. And as a parent, the father, of course, wanted that.
Yeah.
No one wants their kid to suffer. And I say this despite the fact that technically, no parent instinctively wants their child to suffer,
I see what you're getting at, the reality of...
But the reality is that, parents need to also, and I think this is maybe my philosophy of parenting that's based on where I'm coming from, is that parents need to slowly but carefully introduce their children to sufficient hardship that they can learn from it, so that they can make decisions and be conscious of the realities that they are within, I guess.
Help your kids grow.
Yeah. And I mean, help your kids grow doesn't mean, oh, well, I was never given any support when I went to university, so you won't get any. Not that kind of thing. But there are other ways that you can introduce your children, I think, to, like, not spoiling a child is a simple one. Like, kid sees candy, and every time they see candy, you just go, yeah, sure, because I don't want you to suffer the denial of having the thing that gives you pleasure. But you know it's not good for them. But at the same time, you're like, oh, but I can't, you know, they can't possibly deal with the fact that they're being told no. That's like an extreme example of not wanting your kid to suffer. And at the same time, you're making your kids suffer because long term is not healthy to have candy all the time. So I do not envy parents that task. It is very difficult to be responsible for raising your child in a way that enables them to express their talents, to be able to make decisions, to be able to navigate and contribute to the world. And when I talk contribute, I'm not talking monetarily. I'm talking applying their skills and abilities for themselves, but their family and their community to benefit from it. Mm-hmm. There's so much. And then, overall, feelings on the book. I mean, yes, there's an open ending, but there's a reason for the open ending.
Oh, look, it's a great book. Really, really. High recommend, you know. I do have a question that is definitely at the forefront of my mind now that it's done. I believe early on you mentioned that this book is one of the most banned books, at least in the U.S. I am the whole book. I've been trying to kind of see why. And now that we've reached the end, I got to tell you, I have no earthly idea why this book would be banned from like school curriculums.
Yeah. So my thought personally, you're telling children that they can make a difference.
Well, okay, that reason was in the back of my mind, but I didn't want to think that I know. Would be the reason. Because
that's part of it, I think. I think another part, I mean, I can look up exact reasoning they have for it. I know that Calvin kisses Meg once in the book. And so if there's that kind of motivation as to why it's banned, I'd be disappointed, but unsurprised. I'm just going to look it up. A Wrinkle in Time banned? It's been challenged and banned by various groups. Some are saying it's too Christian. Others say it's undermining Christian doctrines by presenting alternative views of good and evil. It's majorly controversial. I have no problem with it in terms of, you know what it is? It's also, it depends on how you view Christianity. And if you are very attached to certain ways of expressing concepts.
Well, yeah. I could tell you from my perspective, like to me, the book was very Christian. I think it was Mrs. Who right before Meg went off at the end. She had that long... Well, it wasn't a quote because she didn't say who it was from, but basically she talked at length about God and the foolishness of man and the weakness of man. And, you know, I don't think it had anything to do with the Bible, but to me, like that, plus a lot of the whole book, heck, at one point, you know, they even talked about Jesus Christ being one of the main fighters.
And the Buddha. Buddha.
There you go.
And like, Gandhi.
If in America, yeah, I could see if you were saying Jesus is one of many that is fighting the darkness, that could be a problem.
It's from Corinthians. So it's a quote from Corinthians.
It is. Good.
And.
But it seemed to me even acknowledging other faiths, the core of the book, the philosophy of the book was overtly Christian.
Yeah. But you also have this bit where, and she doesn't shy away from it. Like, it's very obvious, like, when you, it's in your face. Like, you can see the Christianity in it, but the way her way of presenting Christianity is not that way necessarily that is, I want to say, acceptable in the mainstream views that one sees, at least in the U.S.
Oh, and not nothing about this book and the Christian messaging that I found dogmatic or overbearing.
No. No. I mean, the most dogma that exists was that sentence was, what is it, Mrs. Hu had told her, so she, her interpretation of the quote that Mrs. Hu gave her was actually really cool, because that, I look at it going, well, yeah, I can see why she's saying that. Mrs. Hu said, I don't understand what she said, but I think it was meant to make me not hate being only me and me being the way I am. Because that quote in Corinthians is talking about how you, like, these people were selected to try and put Christianity into practice, right? Mm. God chose those individuals to, the idea that God chose, you don't see yourself as not being worthy. And yeah, so it's like that wisdom. So it's the idea that things, having things isn't necessarily what makes you great. Woof, that's a loud card. Yeah, so I think it's less about, like, it's that you were called into, you're brought into a calling, and your calling is, there's a wisdom in why you've been called into trying to put this into practice. Hmm. So I'm very loosely interpreting, guys, so this is how I'm very loosely. And yeah, the idea that it's like the Sermon on the Mount of Olives, which is a really beautiful kind of things, like, blessed are the meek. Mm. It's not about, you strive for excellence, but just because you are maybe the best reader, the best writer, the best, I don't know, bicycle rider, whatever it is that you are, doesn't make you necessarily living up to your potential in terms of the impact you can have on others. That it's more than just what you have and what you are known for, but that you can make a difference regardless, that you are able to make a difference regardless. So it's like not to hate the fact that you aren't good enough by your own perception of what you think is good enough or not, but to actually just be in the way that you are, to know what you can be capable of, work on what you can be capable of, and strive to make an impact on others. So that was interesting. Yeah, it's like not many of you were wise, not many of you by human standards. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. So in the eyes of men, those people were not really, they're a bunch of fishermen and shepherds, son of a carpenter. You know, like these things were,
kind of thinking about how, this book, you know, humanity is basically, you know, other species, these other planets. They've never encountered humans. They're like, you know, we're back off in the corner of a galaxy somewhere, never interacting with anyone else. And the idea, you know, you talked about that, you may be the best in your field, the best on the planet, but, you know, this book definitely took pulled out the lens and going, yeah, well, you know, the best human at this certain thing might be a speck in the desert, a grain of sand.
Yeah. So it's not about, it doesn't mean don't strive for excellence, do your best, contribute to the world in your way of sharing songs and stories and difference.
Being of service. Yeah.
Yeah. It's your, who you are, depending on your choice that you make. You choose, like Meg in her nothingness, Meg in her the most frail, the least gifted, the most, I mean, the fact that Calvin called her backwards and he was trying to dissuade, was this the original negging? I don't know. So this idea of that Meg is out of all of them, possibly the, you know, the most, not in one world, not in the other, not is gifted, but isn't, but fails, like is a flawed instrument, so to speak. Yeah.
Yet, you know, but she's not ordinary because, well, she's not ordinary. She's very competent in math and science. And
yes, but she's flawed because there's something about her that isn't working. So she's half in one world, half in the other. She's half in the extraordinary and half in the mundane, so to speak, if you want to say it. And so she's not the one that is the most, the father is the one who tests her for the first, like, ooh, no, what? Tests her. And is like some genius person. Calvin is something that is a sport. Yes. Stands out. Is different. Is But Meg wasn't the one that stood out in that way. Mm. Meg stood out for all her flaws, right?
Mm.
But even just with her flaws, she's now and has no confidence in all sorts of things. But she's got that innate, like she stands up for what's right. Even if it's not necessarily to her benefit, she was like, no, that's not right. With her principal, we saw it. She knew she'd been goofing off or that she was struggling or whatever. But as soon as the principal brought in something that was just straight up not right, that was unjust, she's like, no, those are not facts. You are not dealing in facts right now. So it was interesting. Like she's an interesting, she's possibly the most human out of all of them.
Yeah.
So yes.
I also like that line at the end. It was somewhere in that last chapter about how her mother had always kept trying to push her.
Yeah. Her mom was trying to get her to interact with the world because she knew that that was the space that she had to become. Well, she's going to have to deal with the world.
And she's going to have to
interact with the world, yeah.
Felt like she had a lot more confidence that Meg could not only handle it but flourish.
Yes, yes. And part of it is also because she's a lot more like her mom than she realizes that she is, but she is a lot more like her mom. So, yes. But we do need to wrap up. Folks, because now, Dave, you will be introducing what the book will be.
Okay. Yes. So, you know, we will be away for a little while. So it's not as easy as next week. Join us for a new book, as it has been the case for a couple of years now. But
next season.
next time on So Many Books, So Little Time. I have chosen to read another book from the 60s. I've chosen Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. It was the first Vonnegut book I read about 4 to 5 years ago, and I loved it so much that I wanted to read everything this man had ever written since, and I have relegated myself to one new book a year, and I found stuff I like more than others, books I like more than others, but I keep on thinking back to Cat's Cradle as such a wonderful introduction to his work. Now, like Catch-22, my memories of Cat's Cradle are of it being a very funny and absurd book, but this has nothing to do with war, so hopefully my memories don't, you know, the problem with Catch-22 was I forgot how horrific and graphic it could be when looking back on it. Now it's like, well, of course, it's a book about war. It's going to have that. But Cat's Cradle is a science fiction book. So it deals with, it has a couple concepts in there that are completely outside our realm of, you know, knowledge lit, but it's also an absurdist take on religion. So it's actually interesting, especially with how this last chapter of A Wrinkle in Time had such a Christian core to it. It'll be interesting to go right into a book that I won't say it's critical of religion. It plays around a lot with the idea of religion.
Hmm.
So yes, I hope you will join us for Cat's Cradle. It is also, if my memory serves, not a long book, so we might be here sooner than you think.
Yeah. So, excellent. Until then, in between, as we said, we'll be having episodes in between, breather episodes on books that we're reading and just kind of without reading the books themselves. So we'll let you know how that goes. If you have suggestions, please feel free to send them our way. We have our email address, we have the Twitter account, and you can also post or message the Facebook account and we'll get back to you, hopefully. If not there, it will be on the podcast. So for the last time, we tell you that the music at the top of the podcast was by Jeff Danner, and it's the score for the 2003 production of A Wrinkle in Time. That the music at the end of this podcast is, as always, I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me on Twitter at Roo McMoo, that's R-O-O-M-C-M-O-O.
I'm over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip. We have a Facebook page and a Twitter profile, both at SMBSLTpodcast. And if you would like to email us, it's smbsltpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the direction we're taking. If you have any suggestions for books you'd like us to read on the podcast, or even if you'd like us to read off podcast and then discuss it in one of these interim episodes, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Also, if you listen to the podcast on a platform that allows you to rate and review the podcast, we would appreciate you taking the time to do that. Thank you.
Yeah. And so on that note, thank you and happy reading, everybody.
We'll see you next time, whenever that may be. Bye. We'll be right back.